Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Lorna Phillipson from Stewart Forbes Partners and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Bill Green is a former Genentech scientist who is currently a partner with the life sciences venture capital firm of MPM Capital here in San Francisco. Dr. Green trained at Yale School of Medicine, where he also taught medicine and did clinical research. Dr. Green was a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at Yale and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute Research Scholar for the National Institute of Health. His research has been widely published, and he has received awards for clinical research excellence. He received his BA from Wesleyan and his MD degree from the University of California, San Francisco. This is a man who puts his money where his mouth is. He has a passion for the life sciences, and he demonstrates that with his investment choices. He invests in new medical pharmacology and technology to improve our health and our lives. He will discuss tonight doing well by doing good, life sciences in the 21st century. Please welcome Dr. Bill Green.
Thank you. Apologize for starting a few minutes late, courtesy of the Bay Bridge tonight. And thank you, Lorna, and the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to speak with you this evening. A dozen years ago, I left the cozy confines of East Coast academia, and when I did so, all I wanted to do was to make a difference on a scale larger than one patient at a time. And I wanted to be in places where people work to make a difference. In my time at Genentech and now working with smaller biotechnology and medical device companies here in California and around the world, I've been privileged to be around just those sorts of people. I can assure you, biotechnology has made a difference. And I'd like to share a couple stories tonight about how and why it has, and offer a thought or two on where it all might go. The title of my talk is Doing Well by Doing Good, and by the end of the hour, I hope you'll agree that there is, unequivocally, good that has come from the world's investment in biotechnology. That may not be particularly provocative or controversial. What I also want you to take away from all this, though, is that we are all biotechnologists, and always have been. When you read in the paper that the FDA is killing the pharmaceutical industry, or perhaps at the same time killing patients for being too cozy with industry, or that healthcare reform will kill the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry, or that healthcare reform will hopefully kill the biopharmaceutical industry, know that you each have a very personal stake in something so much bigger and more meaningful than an industry or a set of products. The drive to alter living things to suit our needs and to make our lives safer, longer, better, or just more pleasing is at the very heart of what makes us human, and that's not going to stop. Let's begin with a little history. We here in the Bay Area are a very informed lot and justly proud of the role that we have collectively played in the modern history of technology, biology, medicine, and more. As we all know, biotechnology started in South San Francisco in 1976 with Genentech. And it grew into a big company now, and there are lots of other companies that are smaller, and they're kind of pretty much like drug companies, and, well, that's pretty much how it goes, right? Maybe not so fast. It is true that Genentech was the first biotechnology company to grow up and make a drug, and it is true that it has been a spectacular success story, and its therapies have helped countless lives. And it's true that in 2008, there were over 1,700 named biotechnology companies worldwide, employing nearly 200,000 highly educated and skilled people in the United States alone. These companies earned $70 billion in revenue and spent $30 billion in research and development for the next generation of breakthrough therapies. And the industry as a whole actually finally reached profitability as an aggregate for the first time in 30 years in 2008, largely, of course, due to record earnings by companies like Genentech and Amgen. But that's actually not the whole story. While it was not given the lofty moniker of biotechnology until 1919, by a Hungarian pig farmer, by the way, the manipulation of living things and their traits for the use of humans goes all the way back to the beginnings of human civilization. We early on found ways to alter the flora and fauna around us to improve our lives in two crucial areas, food and health. Those wily Sumerians get the credit as the first biotechnologists for their discovery about 1700 BC that something, later known to be yeast, could be captured from the air and from plants and cultivated to brew beer, thus making water much safer to drink, not to mention tastier. Similarly, as early as 500 BC, the Chinese were using moldy soybean curds as a poultice to treat infected boils. They didn't have the words or concepts to call it an antibiotic, much less a pharmaceutical, but it worked. If we fast forward to 1861, Louis Pasteur defined the role of newly discovered and observed microorganisms, established the science of microbiology, and discovered that a cultivatable mold could be used to specifically kill bacteria, penicillin. Pasteur was also the first to describe how and why yeast turned dough into bread and grape juice into wine. Pasteur established the fact that it is microbes that cause food spoilage, and he invented the first process to retard food spoilage, pasteurization, that is still used today, every day. In parallel, people were aggressively using the new science of genetics to select and breed crops for desirable traits. By 1900, a mere 50 years after Gregor Mendel first described inheritance traits in garden peas, classic selection and breeding was being used routinely in Europe to genetically modify crop plants. And to think the modern mantra, no GMO, for no genetically modified organisms, heard ringing through the EU today, comes from the very same historical farming regions that used early genetic modification techniques to produce better wine and wheat. I won't spend more time on agriculture other than to proudly state that I shop at Whole Foods, I buy local and organic, but I also mention that one of the most highly touted of all human interventions in nature, the so-called Green Revolution of the 1970s, was a time in which the United States, financed in quite a significant way by the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations, introduced hybrid, non-native seeds deliberately into Mexico, then India, then the rest of the developing world. Despite a variety of political, historical, and philosophical critiques, it is generally believed to have averted major famine in many countries, most particularly India, and to allow food production to roughly keep pace with population growth. The world population has grown by 4 billion since the beginning of the Green Revolution, an astonishing fact that quite simply could not be true were it not for this whole-scale alteration in farming. India saw annual wheat production rise from 10 million tons in the 1960s to 73 million in 2006. The average person in the developing world consumes roughly 25% more calories a day today than before the Green Revolution. Between 1950 and 1984, world grain production increased by over 250%. Now, one could spend a lifetime debating the impact of this very deliberate genetic intervention on food security, population politics, clean water, biodiversity, even the banking industry. But it cannot be argued that it all started with genetic engineering of seeds, and it continues today. Having said that, it was, of course, the formation of the new field of genetic engineering, in which the actual stuff of genes, DNA and RNA, are cut, spliced, and otherwise manipulated to cause organisms to display more desirable traits, or to eliminate undesirable ones, that ushered biotechnology into the forefront of science and medicine. Initially, the medical use of genetic engineering was pioneered by Genentech, which cloned human insulin and then human growth hormone, creating the first true biotechnology drugs. But not content to rest on the laurels of creating or recreating human proteins, scientists at Genentech and elsewhere sought to create therapeutic monoclonal antibodies, molecules which could be injected into people to have specific, potent, and targeted action. From 1998 to 2002, I had the privilege of working at Genentech. One of my major activities was to work on a program using a new molecule for a disease that terrifies people so much that in one survey, people told researchers they would prefer to die rather than live with it. A disease which is growing rapidly in prevalence, and not only had no cure, but not even a therapy that could slow it down appreciably. That's the kind of project I wanted to work on when I entered the biotechnology industry. The molecule is called Lucentis, and the disease is age-related macular degeneration. More than 8 million people in the United States currently have age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, a disease which causes causes damage to the retina, resulting in loss of vision. AMD is the leading cause of irreversible blindness in adults worldwide. Prevalence is expected to increase by more than 50% to 12 million in the U.S. alone by 2020, and there remains today no curative treatment. Although most patients with AMD have a relatively mild so-called dry form, the fastest growing form of the disease is the so-called wet form. The exact cause of AMD, other than aging, is not fully known. But we do know that when the disease progresses to this wet form, abnormal blood vessels grow under the retina, probably in an attempt to bring more nutrients to the starved and dying cells there. This is associated with a history of smoking, long unprotected exposure to sunlight, light eye color, and the like. Unfortunately, these new blood vessels are very fragile, and much like the abnormal blood vessels that grow into cancerous tumors, they can leak and rupture easily. When bleeding occurs in or under the retina, serious impairment and even sudden or progressive blindness can occur. At least 150,000 people a year in the United States alone suffer permanent visual impairment from AMD. For many years, the therapy for wet AMD consisted primarily of laser photocoagulation to the bleeding areas, or another destructive therapy called photodynamic therapy, or PDT. Some of you may even have had this done in prior years. While these therapies are somewhat effective in stopping the bleeding and therefore stabilizing vision in some AMD patients, the fact remains that in order to stop the bleeding, parts of the retina, the only part of the eye that senses light and forms images, is damaged or destroyed. Beginning more than 15 years ago, scientists at Genentech studied so-called angiogenesis and its causes. The initial and main thrust was to treat advanced cancers by starving them of their blood supply. The initial and main thrust was to treat advanced cancer by starving them of their blood. This research was built on groundbreaking work by Dr. Judah Folkman, widely regarded as the father of angiogenesis. Folkman hypothesized and studied various angiogenic agents at Harvard. Then an amazing scientist at Genentech, Napoleon Ferrara, identified the gene for what he thought would be the most important of these factors, vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, in 1989, and he characterized the molecule as a major regulator of angiogenesis in a broad variety of circumstances, including embryonic development, reproductive function, and tumors. These studies led to the development of a humanized anti-VEGF antibody called Avastin now, which was originally approved by the FDA in 2004 for the treatment of colorectal cancer and later in lung cancer, and is now a major product for Genentech. But not content to merely fix cancer, Napoleon pursued a line of research, also coming out of Harvard, that suggested that VEGF might have a role in the neovascularization that leads to AMD, and the idea that interfering with VEGF might be helpful to patients with this disease. There were a variety of problems, though. For one, Avastin's a big molecule. By drug standards, monoclonal antibodies dwarf the typical small molecule pills that we take the way a mountain dwarfs a grain of sand. We assumed, and animal studies suggested, that the molecule could never reach the back of the eye where the bad blood vessels were. Ideally, therapy would be local, injected into the eye. But even if injected intravenously as it is for cancer, the molecule might get too diluted by its trip through the body to have the desired effect. So Genentech developed a novel antibody fragment about one-tenth the size of the original Avastin molecule that not only retained all the activities of the parent, but was even more potent and targeted. In and of itself, this was quite a technical tour de force. So far, so good. The next problem was proving that it might work. AMD is a uniquely human disease, and there's no direct animal model. We studied it for safety in monkeys, and in doing so got some information. But in the end, the task was to convince management to fund a risky clinical trial in an unknown area that was new for Genentech, where drug companies had really done very little truly innovative research, without even an ophthalmologist in the company. We gathered information about the increasing burden of the disease and burden of diseases of aging in general. We brought an ophthalmologist to discuss current therapy. We crunched all the numbers and showed that we could make money doing it. But in the end, I'm convinced that at some level, the decision to let us go ahead had something to do with this. Patients with AMD are twice as likely as age-matched people without it to be diagnosed with depression, and much more likely to commit suicide. In one quality of life study where subjects were asked to rate the badness of various maladies like cancer, chronic lung disease, and deafness, many subjects actually rated blindness as worse than death, the only condition to receive that dubious honor. Imagine one day waking up and not being able to drive, to read, or see your children. That's what AMD does to people. It's random, brutal, devastating, and can act very quickly. It is literally a fatal eye disease. This is just the kind of big medical problem that inspires those who go into biotechnology and thus end up running biotechnology companies to tackle, and Genentech tackled it. I bought a book on eye disease and actually read it. We flew all over the country recruiting investigators willing to listen to us and to give us a shot at a trial with their patients. And we found something amazing. In the very first study we did with the drug, not only did subjects' vision stop getting worse, but in many cases it improved. How is this possible? We now know, several years later, that in addition to bleeding, many patients' vision is impaired due to leakage of these blood vessels. The anti-VEGF treatment actually dried up the leaky vessels, and the effect of a single injection could last up to a month. Encouraged by the opportunity to develop, literally, the first drug with the potential to improve vision, the company got behind the project full bore, and Lucentis was approved as the treatment for neovascular wet AMD in 2006. It's now a billion-dollar drug and is performing in the real world much as we hoped it would. In that same year, Judah Folkman received the Helen Keller Prize for Vision Research for his groundbreaking research that led indirectly to this therapy. So that's one story. Let's switch gears to something much more old school, and yet something much more global, vaccines. Vaccines have been part of medicine since 1797, when Jenner deliberately inoculated a child with the relatively harmless cowpox virus, thus protecting him from deadly smallpox. Today, we don't know much, most of us don't know much about smallpox, except that it used to be a bad disease. But consider this. Smallpox is believed to have emerged in the human populations about 10,000 BC. During the 18th century, the earliest that people really started keeping track of these things, it is estimated to have killed 400,000 Europeans every year during the century, including five monarchs. It was responsible for a third of all blindness. Of all those infected, at least a third died, and over 80% of infected children died. During the 20th century, smallpox was responsible for 300 to 500 million deaths around the world. In the early 1950s, there were 50 million cases of smallpox around the world every year. As recently as 1967, 15 million people contracted the disease and 2 million people died. However, successful vaccination campaigns throughout the 19th and 20th century led to eradication of smallpox in December 1979. To this day, smallpox is the only human disease to have been completely wiped off the face of the earth. That success led directly to pharmaceutical industry becoming very interested in vaccines for other diseases, and the 1960s and 1970s were a heyday for novel vaccine discovery and production. Industry and the public took the safety and efficacy of routine vaccination for childhood diseases such as measles so for granted that they actually became boring. And pharmaceutical and biotech companies tended to ignore this suddenly old-fashioned idea of research in the 1990s, as it became clear that more sexy diseases like cancer and AIDS would not easily yield to immunologic prevention or cure. But that didn't mean that there was no more unmet need. In fact, by 2003, my partners at IMPM became increasingly excited by the fact that there was relatively little investment in startup activity in vaccines or vaccine companies. We knew that there were great targets, malaria, viral diseases, and many so-called tropical or third world diseases that we suspected would emerge or reemerge in Western consciousness as global travel, commerce, and military activity increased. We set out to find an important disease, a great team, and a solid drug. What we found was Japanese encephalitis and a company called Intercell. Japanese encephalitis is a mosquito-borne viral infection. It's endemic and a major health problem throughout Asia, predominantly affecting children in rural areas of China, Japan, India, and southern and southeastern Asia. However, it's recently spread to new areas, including large swaths of eastern Russia and Australia, due partially to global warming and likely more to agricultural development and an intense increase in rice cultivation worldwide. The mosquito that transmits Japanese encephalitis loves rice plantations. While most infections are likely mild and not even symptomatic in the millions of people it likely infects, of the 30 to 50,000 reported cases every year, 30% of people die, and another 30% suffer severe permanent neurologic sequelae from the brain infection. This is clearly a nasty and scary disease. Japanese encephalitis is not only a threat to people living in the endemic areas, but also to travelers and military personnel who work or travel there. And the CDC and the U.S. military have long advocated vaccination. The only problem was, until Intercell's vaccine came along, the vaccine that was available was arguably worse than the disease. The only licensed vaccine was produced by infecting mice with the virus, then waiting for them to get sick, removing their brains, grinding everything up, and extracting and inactivating the attenuated virus. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this vaccine produced more than its fair share of adverse reactions in its recipients. Vaccination consisted of a schedule of 3 injections over a month, and about 20% of recipients will have moderate flu-like symptoms. No big deal. More alarmingly, up to 1 in 1,000 will have very severe reactions, bad rashes, trouble breathing, and even occasionally death from the vaccine. The U.S. military and the State Department could only recommend that personnel planning on working in endemic areas for a month or more consider the vaccine. Nobody would allow them to mandate it. In 2007, the only producer of this vaccine gave up and removed it from the market. Now, scientists at the Walter Reed Army Research Institute in Washington were developing a more modern version, produced in cell cultures without the use of mouse brains. And it was looking quite good in early studies. But they had a problem. They could only produce it in small batches, and as a government and particular military research institute, they are not clinical trialists, and they're not manufacturers. They didn't have the resources to mount any type of clinical program. They started looking for a partner. We met with the scientists at Walter Reed, with their contacts, and searched literally the world for a small entrepreneurial company with a vision to make money by creating new vaccines. We found it in, of all places, Vienna, Austria. A company called Intercell, which had assembled a terrific team of European immunology and vaccine experts. They were initially focused on discovery of novel targets like new pneumonia vaccines, and were challenging themselves scientifically, looking at therapeutic strategies for hepatitis C and tuberculosis. Still, the company had true development experts and a hunger to produce a real product. They needed that project, and they needed the capital to pursue it. MPM, Intercell, and Walter Reed came together in 2003. We brought onto the board of the company vaccine experts from leading large pharmaceutical companies, designed clinical trials with the help of the United States and Australian military experts to ensure that the vaccine, if approved, would meet their procurement specifications. And we debated the fine points of biotechnology over endless coffees and strudel. In the end, with a lot of dedication by the company and a lot of incredibly generous insight by industry experts on our board, it all worked out. In fact, Intercell went public on the Vienna Stock Exchange in 2005, completed clinical trials and development of the vaccine in 2008, obtained approval worldwide in 2009, earlier this year, and is now a major vaccine development company employing 400 people with a market capitalization of $1.3 billion. More importantly, children, soldiers, and travelers worldwide now have access to a safe and well-tolerated vaccine for a feared global health disease. To me, perhaps the most important outcome from the Intercell story has been the resurgence of interest in the biotechnology and investing worlds in vaccines and global health. The success of Intercell has fueled interest that other so-called third world diseases might be amenable to not only the tools of modern biotechnology, but there may well be good solid profits to be made doing so. Adding good old-fashioned capitalism to the tools brought to bear on global health problems can only be a good thing, and it will definitely make a difference. So that's the present. What about the future? There are a myriad of monoclonal antibodies in clinical development, and no doubt many of them will prove useful in cancer, immunologic diseases like multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis. But that's starting to feel, oh, so 2005 now. Looking ahead, there will be no shortage of innovation. What will be the next big thing? Well, we all know that cancer has not been cured, but therapy and survival are getting better all the time. Presumably, cancer will become, like HIV and AIDS has become, just another chronic disease that we live with as we grow older. Many people think the next horizon is the aging brain. The world is poised for a major increase in Alzheimer's disease and other degenerative diseases of the nervous system. The biotechnology industry is furiously searching for treatments with all the traditional tools, but also with new ones. Vaccines for non-infectious diseases. Nanotechnology to deliver therapeutics deep into the brain in a more targeted fashion. And novel diagnostic tools to identify who is at risk of rapid progression of diseases, thus making them better candidates for invasive therapies. In terms of therapeutic modalities, As we learn more and more about the workings deep inside cells, we understand that it's not just the gene and the protein that determine what happens in the body. There are accelerators and brakes on the expression of individual traits and individual proteins that actually have major effects on how diseases progress. In other words, one person may have cancer, and a second person may have cancer with the same altered genes and the same altered proteins and have very different outcomes and very different disease simply because the expression of those genes is different from person to person. This is an entirely new field called epigenetics and is of major interest in cancer. In fact, we at NPM are funding more than one company to develop entirely new classes of drugs using this information to affect cancer in particular. Probably the biggest scientific news recently that we've all heard about, and thus the area that fires the imagination the most, is so-called regenerative medicine, or more colloquially, stem cell therapy. The idea simply is to not only stop aging or degeneration, but in some cases reverse it by introducing into the body cells capable of reprogramming the existing old dying organs into young vibrant ones. I'm sure you could all imagine a myriad of opportunities to regrow organs, reverse diabetes, repair degenerative arthritic joints. But I'm sure you could also imagine a myriad of technical, not to mention safety issues with growing new organs inside people. So this one is a bit further off. But I would never bet against our ability to figure out the key processes to intervene with, and for sure would not bet against our thirst for better therapies and better life. Me, I plan on being early in line to sign up. Biotechnology is everywhere, not only in medicine. Initiatives in biofuels are a major part of so-called clean tech. And of course, we all eat genetically modified organisms every day, even if we don't want to admit it. But human health and medicine is the core of our quest and will always be the sexiest aspect of biotechnology. From fewer than 10 biotechnology-derived drugs in 1988, there are now over 125 on the market. The hottest activity among pharmaceutical companies is partnering with or buying smaller entrepreneurial biotech companies to gain access to technology platforms, specific expertise, and hot development programs. I might even go further and say that the 100-plus-year-old mainline pharmaceutical companies are also buying an entrepreneurial spirit. They're buying an approach to major unmet medical needs. One story around that is the story of a drug called Proscar that Merck invented. Proscar is a drug that was invented for benign prostatic hypertrophy, an enlargement of the prostate that older men get, which can interfere with urination and cause other problems. Proscar was found to shrink the prostate, relieve the urinary symptoms, and Merck in the 1990s justly thought that they had a billion-dollar drug on their hands. They also found that in members of clinical trials, who are all men, some of them grew hair. In fact, some of them grew a lot of hair. And so the astute marketers at Merck said, maybe we have two drugs. Maybe we have a drug that can cure prostate symptoms, and maybe we can have a drug that grows hair. Now, Merck is a very, very fine company with possibly the best reputation in the pharmaceutical industry for science and for medical ethics, despite all the negative press it's received over the last several years. And the physicians and scientists and business people at Merck decided that they could not possibly get their arms around having one pill on the market that for some people would grow hair and for some people would treat urinary symptoms. So they took the same molecule and developed a low-dose form called Propecia. And they gave two different marketing teams each drug. One Proscar for prostate disease, one Propecia for growing hair. And they told the two marketing groups to have at it and see what they could do. Merck thought that Proscar would be somewhere between $500 and $1 billion and thought that Propecia would be somewhere between $1 and $2 billion. They applied for medical reimbursement, insurance reimbursement for Proscar, and marketed Propecia as a non-reimbursed drug to dermatologists, plastic surgeons, etc. To their surprise, and I think to many people's surprise, Proscar at its peak sold $650 million a year, pretty much right in the middle of the Merck marketing estimates. Propecia sold at peak $150 million a year. Pharmaceutical companies were shocked. Here they were developing for 100 years advanced drugs to do various things and doing pretty well. And then they decided to get into lifestyle medicine and didn't do that great. And I think that many people in the pharmaceutical industry thought that they had just covered the entire range of human maladies. The area that they hadn't covered was big, audacious, risky projects to go after big, really difficult to treat diseases where there was a high risk of clinical failure. That's what the biotechnology industry started to do, and that's why Merck, Pfizer, Sanofi, and all the other pharmaceutical companies are now rushing to re-embrace so-called large unmet medical needs. So more than the numbers, more than the profits, I think this is the outcome of our 30-year investment in the biotechnology industry. We have a creative, vibrant, growing group of dreamers and doers who want nothing more than to tackle big problems here, improve global health around the world, and do it in a way that doctors, patients, and the people with the money can understand and support. That's the essence of doing well by doing good. I recognize that I've started a little late, and in the interest of time, I'm going to stop here and take questions and hopefully have some discussion. So I'd like to thank you for coming tonight, and I'd again like to thank the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco and my host, Lorna Phillips, for having me, and I'll be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you. And now I'll pass the microphone around, and anybody has questions, ask for the microphone and ask your question.
You started by saying that the biotech industry just attained profitability, and the big companies, Genzyme and Genentech, are there. But investment has been a total bust for the past 30 years in the smaller and mid-size. Do you think the industry and investors will benefit from the next wave, and if so, how, or is it simply going to be patient benefits and government confiscating profits?
So that's the doing well part of the equation. It is absolutely true that the average investor who invested an average amount of money in an average basket of small entrepreneurial biotech companies has not done particularly well for a 30-year investment. Much like the California Gold Rush, and much like investing in tech companies in Silicon Valley, though, those who have picked the winners have done very well. And the fact is that this is not big box, rust belt work. This is high risk, high reward work. It's high risk, high reward investing. It remains true that most drug development projects fail, most clinical trials fail, and most products never see the light of day. Those that do are still today enormously profitable and can garner very good returns for public company investors, for venture capitalists, and of course for the stockholders of successful companies. The average company will not be successful. The extraordinary company will be extraordinarily successful, and it will always be a risk. I will also tell you that as a venture capitalist, we're still in business. We're making money for our investors. You know, we invest in a small portfolio of companies in each fund, so not 200 and not one. And as always, the goal is to pick the winners, or at least enough winners.
Okay, as you know, I'm sure Roche just acquired Genentech. So I guess my question really is around, what do you think the effect of having a large global pharmaceutical company like Roche buying up a company like Genentech? and will it stymie innovation, R&D, so forth and so on?
On a global basis, I think it will have little effect on innovation and R&D one way or another. It'll help Roche. Genentech was Roche's largest profit center for a decade. And arguably all Roche did was an astute financial move to move some offshore profits onshore. For the industry and for people interested in the industry, I think there are a couple of potential effects. First of all, Genentech employs about 10,000 people, mostly scientists, and many of those people will choose to work for a pharmaceutical company, and many will not. And in fact, Genentech, like Amgen, like Genzyme, like Biogen IDEC, the largest of the large cap biotechnology companies, has always been a place where people come, work for several years, and more often than not, move on to something else, much like at a university. Most junior professors don't stay forever. Most come, do their work, achieve the next level, and move on to the next place. So if anything, large pharmaceutical companies buying mid-size and even large biotechnology companies will free up an entire new class of entrepreneurs who are now extraordinarily well-trained and accomplished to go and have the financial freedom to try new things. So it may, in fact, be a rebirth at the bottom end of the biotechnology food chain. And secondly, as pharmaceutical companies make lucrative partnership deals and or buy biotechnology companies, that creates liquidity for investors. That means people are making money, and that encourages more investment, which fuels more innovation. So ultimately, I think it's a net positive.
Do you feel the IPO window for biotechs is starting to crack open a little again?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. Over the past 2 months, there have been two biotechnology IPOs, which is not a big number in absolute, but compared to the nearly 18 months when there were none, that's a real change. And also, arguably, like so many other economic indicators, IPOs of companies fall somewhere between leading and lagging indicators. In order for an IPO to happen, hedge funds, mutual funds, and large investors have to decide they're interested in taking some risk and hungry for new issues. That, we started hearing that about 6 months ago. People were tired of sitting on cash and worrying about the future. They wanted to do something. So as those people indicate interest in taking some risk, the obvious question is what kinds of risks? And healthcare and life sciences is definitely one that's been on their list. So the typical cycle is then there will be a bunch of IPOs, some companies will do great, some people will make money, some people won't, and then eventually there'll be a downturn again. Those cycles happen on a 2 to 5 year frame and time frame. And I think that we're at the beginning of an upswing now.
I have a two-part question. The doing good part first is, what do you think of personalized medicine? Is that a myth or is that the way of the future? And the doing well part, how is your company doing well? What kind of portfolio companies are you guys investing in?
Sure. So personalized medicine is yet another of those phrases. Powerful. Is another one of those phrases that has been around for several years and was a promise for a long time. And at this point, I think maybe a lot of people, including in particular a lot of people in the industry, aren't totally sure what it means. Having said that, if personalized medicine means tailoring therapies more individually, saying that a drug may not work for everyone with a disease, but only some people with a disease, and figuring out who those people are, keeping the ones who will have safety problems away from the drug, but making sure we have really good access to the drug for the ones who will have the most benefit. That's here. That's here for a variety of reasons. That's here for purely financial reasons, that in an era of cost containment and, as the first questioner asked, monolithic governments trying to steal profits from poor capital companies, if you are unequivocally saving someone's life, that is always worth a lot, and it is always okay to profit from that in anyone's estimation. On the other hand, if all you're doing is giving someone a rash and their headache isn't getting any better, it's a much harder argument to make post hoc. So personalized medicine is here. The field of epigenetics and cancer is all about personalized medicine. Stem cell therapy, for sure, when it comes, will be very personalized because of the immunologic effects of putting cells from one person into another, like transplants. It will have to be quite personalized to really be effective. And I think from a public policy perspective, regulators and payers will be more than happy to pay for effective personalized medicines. The phrase comparative efficacy has been thrown around a little bit. And while that notionally is about proving that a new drug is better than an old drug as opposed to just proving that it works, it speaks powerfully to personalized medicine because we all know that the current medicines and no medicine works for everyone the same way. So we'll have an opportunity to look at that. On the second part, how is MPM doing? Well, we're doing fine. What are we investing in? Well, we're a very large life science venture capital firm, meaning that we do and always have spanned the gamut from diagnostics, devices, pharmaceuticals, new technology, and specialty pharmaceutical-type drugs that are a little less sexy but more likely to generate revenue. So that basic philosophy hasn't changed. Our basic approach to finding companies hasn't changed. We are doing more work in Asia now. We've always been global. We've usually been about 80% in the United States and 20% outside. In the late 90s and early 2000s, that was mostly in Europe. Now it has shifted and we're doing more companies in Asia, Australia, Japan, even India. We continue to believe that the biggest profits are generally made by attacking big unmet needs with novel therapies. That often speaks to earlier stage companies, and we do a variety of those. But we also invest in a preponderance of mid-stage clinical stage companies where we can understand and impact the course of their clinical trials and their regulatory interactions. And there, where I'd say probably half of our investing has been done, it will continue to be there. We think that the opportunities for helping companies design good clinical trials, helping them get through regulatory interactions, and helping them with the nuts and bolts of product development are as relevant, if not more relevant today than they ever were. And we're investing in cancer companies. We're investing in ophthalmology. We're investing in dermatology. We're investing in orthopedics. So a wide variety. One of the places that we're investing less money in than in the past is big-ticket cardiovascular diseases. So high blood pressure, stroke, lipids. This has become a game for people with a lot of money. To get a cholesterol-lowering drug approved now probably costs $2 billion in development costs. And there's no venture capital firm that's going to put that much money behind a binary red you win, black you lose kind of company.
So back to the doing good scenario as part of doing well. And you've talked about meeting unmet needs. And do you also see opportunity in addressing the needs and market gap toward the base of the world's pyramid, who are lower income people, but who have, you know, much higher prevalence, but perceived per person less ability to pay?
Well, the need is unequivocal. I would say there are two And the opportunity is for sure there. Having said that, turning the opportunity into an action plan has been admittedly difficult, and it's been difficult for everyone. The paradigm in the past has been large pharmaceutical companies give away some drug to the so-called third world. They've been very frustrated by the fact that what the third world does is get some really smart chemists, recreate their drug, and bust their patents, if you will. More recently, approaches to getting good therapies to people with a different socioeconomic organization. It's not that they're necessarily, quote, poor, because being poor is as much a state of mind as a state of dollars. But if we're selling drugs here and we're creating them here and we're selling them for a dollar a pill here and these people make a dollar a day or a dollar a year, that's not going to work. So there's actually a relatively robust conversation happening at various levels about that exact problem and the solutions. Some people think it's patent pools to actually encourage countries to develop drugs with pharmaceutical company and biotech companies' intellectual property, but then not release that IP around the rest of the world. That's one approach. Other people are looking at kind of entrepreneurial grantsmanship to encourage companies to literally form nonprofit pharmaceutical companies to be funded via philanthropy and government money to develop drugs specifically for diseases of the third world. Personally, I think that the ultimate solution is going to be the ultimate solution that's always the case. Giving away money will never teach people to fish. When the rest of the world learns how to develop drugs and actually does it for their own purposes, for their own markets, and for their own diseases, then they'll be self-sufficient medically as well as they've become somewhat more self-sufficient in food and agriculture. Now, that is a big, far-off dream. In fact, the vast majority of all drugs ever developed for anything have not only been developed in the first world, have not only been developed in capitalist as opposed to socialist countries, but they've been developed in the United States. And they've been developed in California, New Jersey, or Boston. So the goal and dream of a worldwide biotechnology industry where everyone can really develop their own drugs is very far off. In between now and then, there, as I said, I think there's a very robust conversation about how to address this. Malaria kills 1 million people a year. The average lifespan of children in Africa is meaningfully lowered precisely because of malaria. This is a disease where there is obviously money to be made, preventing or curing. We all recognize it. It turns out to be a very hard technical problem, but there is one where all the interests are aligned. Likewise, vaccines for many viral diseases of the third world are suddenly much more relevant to the first world because of travel, because of military. So diseases that many of us had not heard of, or if we've heard of, saw in a footnote in a book, like dengue, are suddenly much more interesting. There was a major outbreak in urban areas of Brazil of dengue last year. Business people died. People couldn't go to work. It's a big deal. So there is opportunity, and there's opportunity to develop drugs that could be sold at one price in the Western world and the same drug be sold at a lower price or even given away. But ultimately, there will have to be more indigenous approaches.
So going back to the doing well part, so it's to comment on all the development cycle for pharmaceutical or biotech medicine. The development cycle of 7 to 10 years is a very long time. And I was wondering, what would you comment on how to, what would be the bottleneck in this process, if you can see one, or how can we be more efficient? And on top of it, how is the healthcare overhaul or reforms going to impact on this very high risk and also long development cycle compared to medical device, for example?
So the first part is it takes 7 to 10, let's call it 7 to 15 years, to take something from a good idea to a pill in a bottle. There are a variety, there has been tremendous work on the part of economists, sociologists, lawyers, regulators, doctors, scientists, to figure out what is going on here and how can we chop years off the process. All of them, including the regulators, can only point to one thing that could take years at a time off, and that is all of our favorite activity, bashing federal regulators. So the FDA, for sure, has introduced very big slowdowns and delays in the process, meaning having nothing to do with the safety, nothing to do with the efficacy, nothing to do with how well the companies are doing their job. There is a bunch of years, maybe not a bunch, maybe a couple years of that process that the program spends sitting on someone's desk at the FDA waiting for something to happen. Now, that's not because FDA employees are uninterested or not dedicated or not even hardworking. It's that they're massively underfunded. They're massively under-resourced. Partially because of that, the agency has, with certain exceptions, had a hard time attracting and retaining, arguably, the people who should be the best and the brightest. One could easily imagine a system, maybe a little bit of a utopian system, where the best scientists and doctors went into the biotechnology or pharmaceutical industry. And after they'd been there for a while and been the best, then they would go to the regulatory agency where they would help mentor the next generation of companies and scientists, use their wisdom and judgment to help the right things happen. But the fact of the matter is, the FDA, for most people, is not the most attractive career path. So it's hard to get the best people there. There's good people. Very good people, very dedicated people. In particular, in the beginning of the biotech industry, there was a new division of the FDA called CBER, or the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. CBER did, in fact, attract and retain some of the best and the brightest. And CBER was a shining light, not only within the FDA, but within kind of federal regulatory circles as a place where the government did a good job, protected safety, helped come up with rules. Companies followed the rules, and the right things happened. But that's hard to replicate on a big scale. So maybe that average of 10 could, in a utopian regulatory system, go down to 8. But look, we all want therapeutics that are safe. We all want them to be ultimately safe, almost. And the search for ultimate safety takes ultimately long. So until and unless the royal we are willing to accept more risk in our medicines, it's going to take time. It takes 2 years to get things into animal testing. That's not that long. It takes 2 years or 3 years in animal testing to make sure it's safe enough to try in humans. It doesn't seem like that long a time. It takes 3 years to figure out if it's safe enough and active enough in humans, and maybe you go back and change a few things to get it ready to go into big multi-thousand patient human studies where something bad could happen. That doesn't seem like that long a time. And all of a sudden, now you're up to 9 years. So it's hard to imagine how, with the way that we want to think about therapeutics, there's going to be a fundamental change. And I'm not sure there should be one. As long as there is intellectual property protection for drugs once they're on the market, and as long as the economic rewards are commensurate with the risk so that people can pay the bills and be employed to do it, it's not overtly a terrible system. How will healthcare reform change that? Well, that's anybody's guess. Healthcare reform per se is likely to be, if the outcome of healthcare, let me try again. If the outcome of healthcare reform is to get the 30 million uninsured Americans covered for their medical care, well, on its surface, that's a huge win for everyone. These are people who are probably not getting Avastin or Lucentis right now and could and should if they need it. So at one level, on the customer side, healthcare reform, it should be great for the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries. These are heavily regulated products that have to be proven to work. On the other hand, on the how do you pay for healthcare reform side, there are many proposals in draft legislation to put literally a special tax on pharmaceuticals, a tax on medical devices, a tax on biotechnology drugs. And this isn't a corporate tax. This is a literally special sales tax so that every artificial joint, every injection of cancer medicine will have an extra levy that goes to the federal government to pay for healthcare reform. That will for sure hurt small companies more than big companies. That will hurt emerging companies more than established companies. That ultimately, that price has to be transferred to passed down to the consumer, unless it's not. If it's not, then pharmaceuticals won't be profitable, and nobody will do it.
But do pharmaceuticals need to be this profitable for them to pass on all their costs to the consumer?
Well, I think that depends on how profitable pharmaceuticals are. I think that, again, the classic argument is, look at my Lipitor tablet. I know that it only costs 10 cents to manufacture that pill, and yet they're charging me $3 for every pill. That's usurious. Well, it costs 10 cents to manufacture the pill, but if you actually take all the research and development costs, it's more like $1.50 a pill. If you then add in the cost to the company of all the failures that never got sold, it's more like $2.50 a pill. And all of a sudden, you're buying something for $2.50 and selling it for $3. And sure, pharmaceutical companies spend 30% of their profits on marketing, and maybe that's a lot of marketing, but all of a sudden, it's not so totally outrageous. And if you look at pharmaceutical company stock prices, they're not exactly the darling of Wall Street over the last 10 years. If that's the ultimate arbiter of who's making too much money, Google's making too much money, and Pfizer and Merck are not.
You haven't talked much about diabetes, and yet obesity, the connection between obesity and diabetes seems like it's about the biggest issue here. I have lots of friends from India. It seems like every one of them has diabetes. The question is, I recall that 10 years ago there seemed to be all sorts of little companies focused on things like monitoring glucose. I don't see any activity in that area these days. I'm sure the great big companies must still be doing some legacy stuff, but I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure. Actually, there is a lot of action there, and there's a lot of action in both aspects of what you brought up. One is, you also bring up, by the way, a very interesting epidemiologic issue, which is, why is type 2 diabetes exploding around the world? Sure, it's obesity, but not everyone in India is obese, and they're getting diabetes at an alarming rate. It is a very interesting problem. And by the way, why is obesity exploding around the world? Humans don't evolve that fast. And in the last 50 years, obesity has exploded in a way that if you look at a map, like an epidemiologic map, it looks like a pandemic like swine flu spreading around the world. I don't know the answer to that. Smart people are thinking about it. But it is incredibly vexing, and obesity and diabetes are clearly linked. So a whole bunch of biotechnology companies have started and tried to develop individual therapies or individual devices. Like everything else, most of them didn't work out. The ones that did have largely been partnered with or swallowed up by big companies that can do the huge phase three studies in 10,000 people that have to be done in this area to get FDA approval. So those products are actually, some of them are approved. There are new injectables, drugs like Byetta, which started out as a small biotechnology drug, swallowed up by a big company, moved through the process, and is now on the market. So both drugs, and in particular injectable drugs for obesity and diabetes, have really moved through the system in kind of the right way over the last 10 years. That part in the middle isn't so visible or exciting. So the company gets started, a lot of fanfare, they do some work. Eventually, most of them fail. The ones that don't fail get partnered with big drug companies who then swallow it up and do their corporate thing, and then eventually, kind of at the other end, you get a therapy. So there are at least three new therapies for obesity and diabetes in the last 4 years. They've been big wins, and they are the one, the cream that has risen to the crop, to the top of the crop of metabolically oriented biotech companies 10 years ago. That is a very hot area. There are still lots of companies getting started. It is very high risk because, unlike a car accident, diabetes isn't something you die from tomorrow, and therefore the safety and regulatory hurdles are that much higher.
Thank you. I want to thank Dr. Green for his comments here today, and thank all of you for listening, and our audience by audio recording listening, and the Commonwealth Club meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.